Jefferson, Mr. Huitink.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Huitink. I'm with the law firm Godfrey & Kahn, SC in Milwaukee. We accepted an appointment and are representing Mr. Severson on this appeal. Your Honors, there are really four issues that we've raised on appeal here. The first two go to the knowledge and intent for the aiding and abetting offenses, the ten of them outlined in our brief. There simply was no evidence in the record at this trial of any knowledge or intent required for these offenses on these three loans for which he was convicted. He has been convicted for other crimes under the evidence.
Well, he knew he had no money, and he wrote all these checks or had his employee write checks on basically non-existent accounts to create the impression that he was that he had a positive balance. So,
well, if I may, Your Honor, those were
the jury couldn't find that he knew that he was doing something illegal.
Sure. On these three particular loans, Your Honor, there simply was only one piece of testimony at all in the entire record about what, if anything, Mr. Severson knew about the approval of these loans by the board and what was communicated to the board.
The approval by the board is the critical issue.
And I respectfully disagree, Judge.
Well, what's critical is he knows there are no funds in his account.
He knows that he does not have any idea what's communicated.
He does not have any funds in his account, but he is writing phony checks to create the appearance that he has funds.
On other loans.
And he's doing this as an accommodation to Hardiman, who doesn't want to get into trouble when his fraud is revealed. So I don't know what more you need for a...
Sure, and those checks were written on other loans, Your Honor. The one piece of evidence I was referring to was a statement and some testimony on the record by Mr. Hardiman that he did, in fact, tell Mr. Severson that the board had not approved these loans. The problem, as we point out in our brief, and under the Giovanetti case...
But isn't the key issue, as to each of the charges that he's challenging, whether Mr. Severson had an intent to defraud? And at the very least, he knew he was helping Mr. Hardiman circumvent the rules, and he knew that he was covering his own insolvency. So truly, what more would you need?
Sure. That's all the government did need to convict him on the loans where that happened, Your Honor. And on these three particular loans that are issued on appeal, he applied for the loan. There's no evidence that he knew the board of directors didn't approve these loans.
Harping on the board of directors. If the board of directors approved, that would just show they were in cahoots with Hardiman.
I don't believe that's true, Your Honor.
If the board of directors approved phony loans, how does that help Severson?
Sure. If the board of directors chooses to approve it, it helps Severson because he's not aiding and abetting anything. He doesn't have the knowledge or intent to do that.
I don't understand you. Suppose Hardiman says to Severson, "Don't worry, the board of directors is there. We're all in it together. They know the bank is bankrupt, and you know we're keeping it alive with phony checks." How would that exonerate Severson?
I think if he had said that to Mr. Severson, that would be direct evidence of knowledge and intent necessary to convict. We don't have that here.
I do not understand the relevance. I do not understand what the board has to do with this.
Sure.
The board can't approve illegal conduct.
And our position, Your Honor, is that someone in Mr. Severson's position wouldn't know that. He knew that the board had to approve loans. If the board approved loans, how can he be guilty of knowingly or intentionally aiding and abetting?
Well, that's like saying if Hardiman approved loans, how could he know he was, right?
Oh,
what difference does it make?
Big distinction there, because Hardiman is in the business. The distinction is, on this record, you're not dealing with somebody who knows beyond board approval what these loans are about. Other than some discussion about lending limits in the past.
Suppose there was no board of directors. What difference would that make to Severson? You portray him as completely naive. What does he know about boards of directors?
Sure. He knew enough to ask the question on one undated occasion to ask whether or not the board of directors knew to approve those. That was the extent of his knowledge. Now, moving on, we also
Well, that's why the ostrich instruction was given here. Because... his defense essentially was that he's following Hardiman's instructions, and he has no idea that he's doing anything wrong, and yet he's depositing all of these NSF checks into his account, for example. Wouldn't it be a red flag when Mr. Hardiman said to him, hey, look, you know, we've got to make it look like your accounts are not overdrawn?
I believe that would be the case, Your Honor, on the other loans and the other transactions that we're talking about, not on these three loans. The evidence in the record on...
But I don't know how you separate them. I'm surprised there isn't more discussion of the other transactions. Given his rampant illegality, why would he think these were legal transactions? Everything else he's... does is knowingly illegal. Why would he think this was legal?
By way of example, Judge, the largest one at issue, and it's actually two $400,000 loans, is for something he'd never done before. It was the purchase of a motor speedway. He ends up securing that at a later date with a mortgage. But to look at someone in Mr. Severson's position and to say, okay, we got in trouble on these other loans.
You have someone who knows that he's engaged in all sorts of illegalities involving the bank. Why would he think these three loans were anything different? He's dealing with a crook. He knows he's dealing with a crook. What? He also knows these loans have no... He's not entitled to these loans. He has no money.
And I think, Your Honor, there's the fundamental disconnect we have. I think if Your Honors believe that the evidence of the illegalities on the other loans and other transactions factors into any direct or circumstantial evidence of his knowledge and intent, then he's going to lose on the aiding and abetting knowledge claim in this case. Our position is they don't. On these three particular loans, he applied for a loan. One he subsequently secures with a mortgage.
Why would he be applying for these, you know, million-dollar loans when he's got no money?
He's got, well, in the one case, he had a speedway to pledge that paid off a pretty good chunk of it ultimately.
Ultimately. But he had no... That was rigged up after when the audit was approaching. He didn't...
And I do want to move quick...
secure it when he got the loan.
I do want to move quickly, Your Honor, before I lose time here into the last two arguments, which deal with the calculation of his sentence under the sentencing guidelines.
Well, look, I don't understand your response to the government. The intended loss was the whole amount of the loan. The collateral was an afterthought.
Yeah, under the Mao case, Your Honor, that we cited in our brief, the intent is determined at the time the fraud is uncovered. What the district court did is it looked at...
No, the intent is at the time the fraud is committed.
That's not how we read the Mao case, Your Honor.
That can't be right.
Yeah, the Mao case, it says specifically, when calculating intended loss in a fraudulent loan case, the amount of the loan...
You calculate a person's culpability on the basis of what he does when he does it, not what happens at a trial years later.
Simply quoting...
That would be ridiculous. I think what that would mean for an embezzlement case. If the person returns the money by the time of the trial, that's not a loss to the bank?
No,
that's ridiculous,
I think that's different.
Why is that different?
It's different. If the person returns the collateral after the fraud is uncovered, and that's what the Mao case is dealing with, then obviously it doesn't count
anymore. Embezzlement. You steal the money, you intend to return it, you do return it. It's still embezzlement, and that's the intended loss. When you, borrow a huge amount of money that you know you can't ever pay back, and you don't seek collateral, that's the intended loss. If later you say, maybe I ought to return some of this money, so I'll get collateral so it won't be as big a ripoff, that doesn't affect the intended loss.
And with all respect, Judge, I think that analysis is inconsistent with the Mao case. It simply says that it's determined, quote...
There's nothing wrong with that case, because this is extremely elementary stuff.
And all we're doing is quoting from...
Calculate the loss, the intended loss, at the time of the crime, not some later date.
If that's the case, and I think this court needs to alter the Mao decision that speaks about at the time the fraud is discovered. The last issue we have on the sentencing guideline is the...
That doesn't make any sense.
The last issue we have on the sentencing guideline is the inclusion of this prior misdemeanors under Wisconsin law, and I believe the government, and we agree on the...
I don't see the point of this. Look, because the guidelines are advisory, if Judge Crabb thinks, for whatever reason, that this selling liquor at the racetrack is more serious than the other listed crimes, she can do that, right? She's not bound by the Sentencing Commission's judgment as to what is a trivial crime. Trivial crime. She's not bound by that.
Sure. And, Your Honor,
differently, if we think it's a trivial crime, she doesn't have to think it's a trivial crime. Obviously, she didn't.
Sure. My response to that, Judge, and I see my time is up, is simply that you have a similar misdemeanor in that sentencing guideline. It talks about driving with a suspended.
It doesn't matter. She can say, I don't think it's, I think this is more serious, selling liquor at a racetrack.
And not only that, you know, the 140-month sentence that Judge Crabb imposed was below what the guideline range would have been even without the extra 1 point in his criminal history. The fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, she gave him a break.
She gave a huge downward departure, Judge, and the end of the Garrett discussion discusses about when a remand is necessary, even when it falls within or without that range. Our position is it goes back in the range if she gives the same 28
departure. Well, I will tell you something. I'd be terrified to go back if I were you.
He's not.
Because she might just decide. She might just decide that 140 months should have been 180 months. She might have had.
That is a distinct possibility, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
See, no good deed ever goes unpunished.
I'm sorry?
See, no good deed ever goes unpunished. Thank you for accepting your question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hoytink. Mr. Johnson?
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Grant Johnson, Your Honor. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney from the Western District of Wisconsin. As defense counsel indicated, there's basically four issues in this case. We have sufficiency of evidence, deliberate avoidance, the loss issue, and then the issue relating to the one-point criminal history.
What can you add to what Judge Posner has already done with those arguments?
What was that, sir?
I said, what can you add to what Judge Posner has already done with those arguments?
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
What can you add with your argument that Judge Posner has not already provided?
Nothing. He wants you to sit down.
I will sit down then.
But
thank you.
You came all the way from Milwaukee. No, you're...
Before the next blizzard comes.
We're happy to listen.
Unless there's some questions, I'll be happy. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. And Mr. Hoytink, thank you very much for accepting the appointment and your vigorous...